most of you, well, we'll say all because it's right, all of you have an inner or internal dialogue. You may not realize this, and when I speak of it, I'm not talking about that you hear funny voices telling you to eat dog food and things like that. You have, though, within you strong impressions, voices, the kinds of things that when you're about to do something, you sense sometimes, I don't know if I should be doing this, the kinds of things that make you think, oh, this is good, the kind of thing that make you feel something is urgent when maybe it isn't, or make you feel ashamed when maybe you shouldn't be, or make you feel ashamed and guilty when you should be. And these internal dialogues, as you may realize, are often heavily influenced and formed by the voices of your parents as you're growing up, these people with whom you spend ordinarily a great deal of time. Their impressions are imposed upon you, their words are spoken at you. You take their whole personality into yourself in the formation of your own. So that even now, there are people in here, no matter what your age, some of you in more of the senior years of your life, where you are on the verge of doing something, buying a car, buying a house, and you can think to yourself, if my father knew how much money I was spending right now on this gadget or a car or whatever, he would roll over in his grave. My mother would be so glad to see what is happening in our house right now, you might think. You know, don't you? Sometimes what ought to be done or what ought not to be done, because you've been around your folks so much that they have these powerful impressions on you that form so much of what you think about. You have taken them into yourself. You have the knowledge of them, and it has helped form you and shape you. As we're talking about calling for the past few weeks and for the forthcoming ones, we've been talking about this whole idea that God has summoned us awake, taken people with God allergies and made them someone who desires Him, who wants to be on His team, who wants to collaborate with Him in the rehabilitation and repair of a dilapidated world. And that a big part of calling, as the Bible talks about it, is just this calling, this summons to be made like the one beautifulest, truest expression of humanity, namely Jesus. So far more than what street you live on, or what car you drive, or what career or job you should take, or which person you should marry, or which major you should have, God is concerned about recreating a whole swath of people. He's a great champion turkey caller. And He wants all you turkeys in on His project to remake the world. And so His call, before it gets into all the particularities, is very much concerned with knowing who He is. That's how J.I. Packer described conversion. Being born again, it's giving as much as you know of yourself to as much as you know of God. And of course, that's what calling is in the broadest sense, is this summoning of God, making us awake and us giving ourselves as much as we know of ourselves to as much as we know of God. And what the apostle hopes will happen, as he is talking about this in Colossians, is that eventually the ways that your parents formed you, well, your knowledge of God will begin to do the same exact thing. You'll begin to get a sense, a horse sense, of what God's up to in the world. What kinds of things does He care about? What is He really like? What does He love? What does He hate? And so Paul prays this. He says, for this reason, since the day we heard about you, we haven't stopped praying for you and asking God to fill you with the knowledge of His will through all spiritual wisdom and understanding. He wants your internal dialogue to be formed by God's wishes. That's what He's saying. That's part of your calling. You want to know, why am I here? What am I up to? I want you to get a horse sense for God. so that you may live a life worthy of Him and may please Him in every way. Because He knows the great point of your life, who've been swept up in Jesus' call, is that you would live for His pleasure. That's why I've entitled the sermon today, The Call to a Pleasant Life. It's a deceptive title, because most of us want a pleasant life, but we don't always think about living a life that is pleasant to God. And this is part of what the Apostle Paul is praying, is that it would begin to be so much an acknowledged part of our reality, what God wishes, what God wants, that is actually the place of thriving and flourishing for us, that we would want that too. And we would ask the question, how can I please the Lord? How can my life please Him? And you know, a starting point for this kind of knowledge of God, where He's forming who you are, where you're asking the question of, can I please Him, is just simple acknowledgement. And that's the first point. In order to please God, in order to know what your calling is, you have to have acknowledgement of God in your life. In Romans 1, and I know this seems overly simplistic to you, you guys are like God experts and everything, but in Romans 1, one of the things that happens in a culture of decline is that people know God, but they don't pay Him any mind. They don't give thanks to Him. They don't honor Him. They eventually just edge Him out. It doesn't necessarily feel like rebellion so much as it just feels like, well, He's irrelevant. In post-Christian places, I've got a good buddy, you've heard me talk about him, and on the left coast out there, some of you do not like by virtue of its leftness, but there are people there who have written off Christianity, not because they considered it, because they didn't think anyone with any intelligence had ever considered it. No one actually believes any of this stuff anymore. Most of the people in their walking around shoes think. And so I would just say to you today, do you know that tomorrow morning when you wake up, a very valid question to ask is, how can I acknowledge the Lord? Lord, how can my life be pleasing to You? What kinds of things do You want me to care about? What kinds of things would You like me to be about? Because I belong to You after all. Do you think about that? Just simple acknowledgement. Because knowledge comes from acknowledgement. When the Israelites in Hosea have been ripped to shreds by God, and they say, come, let us return to the Lord. He has mauled us, but He's going to mend us. He's torn us to pieces, but He is going to paste us back together with the glue of His affection. Come, let us acknowledge the Lord, they say. Because the first step of all this is you start in your economic life, and your sexual practices, and your relationships, and the way you conduct your business, you start to forget to think about the fact that the Lord, the King of heaven and earth, might care about how you're doing your marriage, how you're doing your business, how you're doing your studies, how you're using your body. And so it's valid to say, oh Lord, let us acknowledge You. How might we please You here? If you're going to grow in the knowledge of God, if you're going to know who you're called, you've got to acknowledge God. And then you've got to, which is very correlated, you've got to pay attention to Him. It's part of what Paul is praying here, that you'd have knowledge of His will through all spiritual wisdom and understanding, that you might live a life worthy of the Lord, that you might please Him in every way. One of the things that you may not think about very much is that for people who've been called to love the Lord their God with all their heart and mind and soul and all other stuff, is that one of the main ways that you love people is by paying attention to them. Do you understand that? If you think about it, it doesn't sound so sexy. It's not the kind of thing that's going to sell a Jennifer Aniston movie. But if you really love somebody, one of the main things you do is you let them influence you. You pay attention to them. You let their words alter you. I had a friend when Kathy and I were first married. a neighbor, next door neighbor. And this man was from Texas, and that tells you all you need to know about him. And his wife, God love her, was from Canada, which meant from the outset they had some issues. Just kidding. It's a joke. Well, my friend, one day, as I was admiring his truck that was larger than our house, a Dodge Ram 25,000, that's not a real thing, 2500 turbo diesel something, that if he had wanted to, in a nefarious state, could have pulled the house off the foundation with. I was talking to him about this truck, and he told me the story of its origins, or how it came to reside in the family that he and his wife were presently beginning. He came home from his job one day, a construction job, and he decided to stop by the Dodge dealership without consultation of his sweet Canadian wife. He bought that sucker, and he drove her home in all her beauty, larger than our neighborhood. And he said, "Oh, you can bet I was sleeping on the couch for 3 days after that." And you think, why would his sweet Canadian wife be mad about him buying a gigantic truck that was bigger than Nashville? Well, he didn't consider her. He didn't take her into account. She took it as a violation of love. And most of you listening think, yeah, she probably thought of it right. He probably should have asked before he got them on the hook for a lot of debt to pay for a lot of truck. It probably would have made her feel like she was someone valuable in his life if he had paid attention to her, wondered, what might my wife think about this if we buy something we can't afford? If I buy something gigantic and don't even consult her? See, when you love somebody, you pay attention to them. You let them influence you. That's why good marriages, your spouse, in a way, is kind of carried around with you. You know what kinds of things that your spouse might like or not like. M. Scott Peck tells the story of going to listen to a lecture. And a man who was trying to talk about the convergence of psychotherapy and religion, something he was greatly interested in. And he was in this lecture hall listening to this man that he greatly esteemed. And as the man started talking, Peck said, "You know, I've studied this stuff a lot, and I realized very early on this man was a master. And I was paying so much attention that soon my face was sweating. It was dropping sweat in an air-conditioned room. And by the end of his talk, this complicated, meandering, and very dense talk, my neck was sore. I had a throbbing headache. I was emotionally drained from the attention I had given. And I reckon that I had probably only understood about 50% of what he said. But it was profound. It was influential. But I was not surprised when I went out to the lobby and I heard most of the people there saying, 'He's not a very good speaker. He kind of wanders all over the place. I thought this would be lots better than it was.'" And Peck, who had gotten so much out of this but had taken so much out of him to do it, realized the problem is it's hard for us to listen. It's hard for us to pay attention. We don't think of it as something that should be a lot of work. But all love is work, and all attention giving is work. And the apostle, of course, would have you realize if you're going to grow in the knowledge of God, you're going to try to please Him in every way, you're going to live a life that is commensurate with the magnificence of this calling you've been swept up into, co-laborer with God, you got to know what God thinks about things. You got to take Him into yourself. You got to pay attention to Him. A few weeks ago, you saw Timmy Mailer, the voice of the Covenant Scots, get up here and recite, I think, the first chapter of Colossians. I can't remember what he recited exactly. I just remember that it was powerful. And you know what happened is he started this. We asked him to do that. He started this because a friend had gotten up and recited the book of Hebrews. Yes, the book of Hebrews. Not the word Hebrews. And it took him 45 minutes or an hour to recite it, which means it took him about probably 100,000 hours to memorize it all. That's hyperbole. And Tim, when he saw this, realized this had a powerful effect on this guy, my friend. I might art to do that. And so he started memorizing things, and I'm using him without permission. Sorry, Tim. But you know what's powerful to me to think about? And I'd like to challenge some of you. Some of you need to memorize large swaths of the Bible. More than you just need to start daily Bible reading, you just need to devote yourself to memorizing some large chunk of it. A chapter of an epistle, some psalms, something. Because you know what happens as you do this? You're giving an awful lot of attention to God. You can't memorize things like this on the fly. I read an article not too long ago called, Is Google Making Us Dumber? And the whole idea was that we are losing the capacity to know things because we know where to find them. And that's good and all. But you wouldn't want to go to a doctor who had to Google stuff when he was examining you, would you? You can do that and drive yourself crazy and think you have 17 terminal illnesses. You want a doctor who has memorized the systems of the body and how they work together. You want a doctor who's seen things, who's appropriated knowledge, who's paid attention and made the body his study. The world would like to see people like us who have made God's Word, made God Himself, the story that He's up to, what He loves and hates and cares about in the world, our study. Some of you need to just spend the time it takes. It will be a spiritual discipline. Just the time it takes, the familiarity and the acquaintanceship that it takes to memorize stuff. It'll change you. It wasn't for theatrical effect that Mela was up here weeping as he recited. Because when you get the words that spoke the constellations into being, into your being, they start to mess with you. They start to introduce you to the knowledge of God. They start to make you think, I wonder what God cares about. It starts to be something you can carry with you in the work that you do, in the studying that you do, in the play that you do, in the family life that you conduct. Most of you have memorized the bad news. I read an essay by a poet this week, and that's what she said. A guy told me, I've memorized the bad news. Most of us recite and rehearse the bad news. Are you giving attention to God, doing the work of saying, He's so valuable. Maybe in a world of bad news, this thing we call good news, gospel, maybe I need to take it into myself so I get a horse sense for God, so I can know how I am to live. So you got to acknowledge God. You got to give attention to God. And then you got to ask of God. It's interesting to me that just this passage that Lisa just read, verses 9 through 14, the apostle is telling this church that he loves, that he's telling them what he prays for them. And now I am not a good biblical scholar, and I may not be the most attentive reader in the world, but listen to this. The fact that Paul is always telling churches what he prays for them seems to suggest to me that it means that he prays for them. This is a magnificent intellectual discovery of mine. If he's always telling churches, here's how I pray for you, it must mean that he prays for them. And of course, he does. And of course, he realizes that this whole interplay, if we're going to be the image of God, if we're going to represent God in the world, we've got to pay attention to God, we've got to acknowledge God, and then we're going to have to talk to God a good bit so that we get spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that we have endurance and patience and can joyfully give thanks to the Father. Mary Carr, who is a poet, a recovering alcoholic, she talks about her unlikely move to Catholicism, her startling renaissance as a person interested in God, devoted to Christ. And she talks about how this all started by the fact that she started to pray. And she was starting to give reasons for why she thought to pray and what was kind of happening in. She starts one sentence this way, as she's trying to give this justification, as if she's saying, okay, enough bull. I couldn't stop drinking. That's why I started praying. I couldn't stop drinking. I tried everything else but prayer. And so I decided, because a good friend said, how about in the morning you kneel on your knee and say, God, help me not to drink cocktails today. That's how her spiritual life started. I couldn't stop drinking. What can you not stop doing? Being critical, looking at dirty pictures on the internet, being stingy, being mean, being resentful of others. What can you not stop doing? Eating 3 and 4 bags of Santitos at a sitting? Some of you have confessed this to me. What if what you can't stop doing, what if what is presently eating your lunch is God's invitation to say, hey, I mean that business that I said earlier about apart from me, you can do nothing. That you're like a meant to be this red delicious apple on a party apple tree, but as soon as you get off that sucker, you're going to turn brown. Rotten. You're going to stink. But if you remain in me and I, my words remain in you, ask of me whatever you wish. That sounds dangerous. And I'll do it because it is my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. That's what Paul's praying here, that you bear a lot of fruit, that you just have good stuff flowing out of you. And you know how that good stuff flowing out of you starts? By spending time saying, God, I don't know how to use you. You're going to have to do some exceptional stuff through me. You're going to have to help me understand what you're like. You're going to have to empower me. You're going to have to work against me maybe because I know what kind of person I am. You're going to have to give me courage in the middle of my fear. You're going to have to lift this depression. You're going to have to take this anxiety. You're going to have to change things at work. You're going to have to change things in the world. You're going to have to talk to him a lot once you start doing it. But if you're not doing it, pray short so your soul demands long. Pray a tiny bit. Start with, help me not to have a cocktail today, if that's your deal. Paul Miller says, if you're not praying, then you are quietly confident that your time and your money and your talent are all you need in your life. None of us starts out that way. None of us says at the beginning of the day when we wake up in the morning and don't even need coffee because we've got an anxiety rush. We have a buzz of worry getting all 8 cylinders flurrying quickly. And we think, I've got real things to do. I've got responsibilities. People need me. There's money to be made. There's diapers to be washed. Don't wash diapers. That's an old-timey thing. Cleaned, changed. There's responsibilities. People need me. Things have to be done. Real things. I've got tests. I've got to file my taxes. There's a board meeting. What you're quietly saying, if you don't ask God, who's always saying, call on me in the day of trouble and I'll deliver you. Who's always saying, ask of me whatever you wish. So that the Son may bring glory to the Father. So that you may bear much fruit. When you don't do it, you're saying, I don't really believe you. Talking to you is not really a real thing because you're not really a real thing. Don't make that mistake. Because you're depriving yourself of living out this joyous calling you've been given. A resource that's meant for you. You got to ask God. You got to ask God. Acknowledge Him. Give attention to Him. Ask Him. And the last thing is this. If you're going to fulfill this calling of His to please the Lord in every way, you got to be amazed by Him some. And you can ask Him for that as well. You got to be amazed by God. You know, Paul says this. He has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son He loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. I want to say, because we're in an angry cultural moment right now, where a lot of Christians are very nervous that our culture is acting like it's under the sway of the dominion of darkness, except actually we don't act like that. We act like we forget that. You know, the apostle says, the unique thing about you, church at Colossae, and as we read over their shoulders and hear church at Rock Creek Fellowship, is that you have been plucked out of the dominion of darkness. You know, dominion means a dark force is ruling over you. You always do what you're ruled by. You always are held sway. You move according to who's ruling you. And Paul's saying, you're not ruled by darkness anymore. You're people who have been swept up out of the raging river of wickedness. Now you're getting dried off and you're getting warmed up so that you can be not just carried along by your own desires, you can be carried along by a desire that is good. Now, isn't it interesting if you believe that? You're really deeply forgiven. You've been swept up into the story. You've been put into a different kingdom. Don't make the mistake of thinking America's that kingdom, and then we won't be so angry at everybody all the time. Not you, particularly. But you know, when our government and our leaders and our culture and our movies and all of these things are wicked, how would you think they shouldn't be? We're under the dominion of darkness. Do you believe that kind of stuff happens? Why shouldn't they act in accord with how they are? How can we expect them to be way different than they are unless they get plucked out too? If you start to think you're someone who got plucked out though, and you start to get really acquainted with God and His heart for the world, you may say like Oswald Chambers, I am so amazed that God has altered me, I can never despair of anybody. I am so amazed that God has altered me that I can never despair of anybody. And it's gladdening that he says a thing like that and that Paul says and recognizes that his prayer is so we might have power, so we have endurance and patience. You know, you need endurance in impossible situations. You need patience for impossible people. One commentator said, you live in a culture. We live in a time. In impossible situations, impossible people, and we have the power that raised Jesus from the dead at work in us, available to us through prayer, and we have been swept up into this effort. What if you believe that? It really would change the finger wagon. I told you about that guy, right, when I first came out here, a preacher. I'm the preacher, I guess. He said to me, now, you ain't one of them finger wagon preachers, are you? Because his expectation was that's what preachers do, is they wag their fingers at you. They yell at you. And of course, that's what the world thinks that Christians do. They wag their fingers at you. They yell at you. But what if we're the people who have deserved to have our fingers wagged at other people's fingers, God's fingers wagging at us, and he didn't do it? He said, I want you. I'm going to dry you off. I'm going to clean you up. I'm going to make you something different. I'm going to let you be a spotlight for what my reconciling power can do, what my renovating mercy can do, so that you can be a picture of it for the world. You heard this week, and this is the last closing thing, about a story. It went all over the worldwide interweb. I read about it in The Atlantic. It was called, Should What Happens at Applebee's Stay at Applebee's? The commentator was referring to a story that surely you heard about, a pastor, happily, who had been eating at Applebee's with a bunch of church folk, apparently. And after the mandatory and customary 18% gratuity that was automatically tacked on for parties of six or more, this pastor scratched out the obligatory tip, the gratuity, and wrote, I give God 10%, why should I give you 18? And then signed the name, Pastor, whatever the woman's name was. Now, the server was obviously a little bit freaked out and probably a lot mad about that. And so showed it to one of her friends, and her friend took a picture of it and posted it like anything bad you do is going to happen to you. It's on the worldwide interweb. Tweeted it and Facebooked it and Reddited it and all that. So, before you know it, this pastor's act of bravery was out there for God and everybody to see. Now, apparently, this pastor then called Applebee's and asked that this woman be fired. Now, it is not my intention get onto this passage. But it is my intention to say, as someone who could easily, if my life was videotaped for the world to see, have just as many embarrassing things about me, wouldn't it be amazing if we were the kind of people who knew that we had been redeemed? Who knew we had been plucked out of darkness? What if that pastor had said? What would the world have done if she had said? Instead of calling Applebee's and asking that she be fired, if she had asked to get on TV and say, I just want to thank that woman for shaming me publicly because I needed it. Because she introduced me to myself. When I saw what I had done out where everybody could see with new eyes, I thought, oh, goodness. I worship the generous God who has withheld nothing from me. Was I seriously in a state of momentary insanity where I thought that everything was about percentages with him? I lost my head. I'm the kind of person who didn't do it just that time. I do it all the time. I'm thankful she brought it to the world's attention so that I could bring to your attention the fact that I'm even worse than that. But my Savior is way better than that. And even in these difficult conditions, and even with difficult people like me, he says, I still want you anyway. What if instead of finger wagging, we had that posture with people? With the people with whom we disagree, with the people who are not living righteously. If we knew that we were the people who had been plucked out of the dominion of darkness, that we were being empowered to not give up, empowered to start giving thanks, empowered to know the God for whom we were made. I think it'd be pretty neat. We might just live a life that's pleasant to God. Let's pray.